What are the benefits of just talking in the classroom? This week on Back Porch Education Podcast, I talk with a longtime proponent of the seminar. Join me in talking with John Donahue about the modern seminar. Well, welcome back to the podcast. Back Porch Education Podcast is happy to have a guest today, someone I have worked with and known now for several years. His name is John Donahue, and he has somewhat of a unique perspective to bring to our topic today. I want to talk about what I do on a daily basis and what he does on a regular basis, which is lead young people through the great conversation of the great books using the methodology of seminar in class and thesis writing or paper writing about that experience outside of class. And every year my seniors go through this. I'm actually using the program that John put in place at my high school. He has moved to another school now, and I'll let him tell you about that in a few minutes. But we have the opportunity to speak with John today about his many years experience using both the thesis paper and the seminar Socratic methodology format in class. So John, welcome to the program. Why don't you just catch us up on what it is that you do and where you've been and where you see yourself heading.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here, and thank you for the invitation to talk about Socratic method and the great books. I've been in Catholic education, private independent education, for almost 38 years now, in the past 15 years as an administrator. But I taught I went to a great books program, a small liberal arts college that had a great books program and undergrad. And the curriculum was selected from the great books that Mortimer J. Adler put together and some additional books besides. Some of the faculty members that I learned under were from a well-known great books school, St. John's. The school I attended was actually a Catholic school, so we had an opportunity to read John Henry Newman's idea of a university and the value of theology being a piece of that. So that was my undergraduate experience. I did go to do some graduate work in political philosophy at Boston College, and actually that was a very similar kind of program. We read original source material. They were small classes. We wrote papers and we engaged in dialogue, in discussion. And I took a teaching position right after that at another small Catholic liberal arts school and taught in a high school as well. And then ended up back at my alma mater for 20 years teaching in the Great Books program, seminar program. And moved from there to a high school program. For a variety of reasons that I won't go into at this point, but there was high school, middle school, and did teaching in the seminar, again, reading original source materials with high school students. And it was kind of an experiment for me because I hadn't taught at that level, but I was really encouraged by the success we had there, and then began also in the middle school area as well. Currently, I'm in a pre-K through eighth grade, and much to my pleasant surprise, when I got here, they had done what they called Socratic circles, and I can't recall the name of the text right now, but one of the faculty members had learned about Socratic method, hadn't been to a great books program, but recognized the value and had some training in it, so I was able to sort of pick up on that. As you mentioned, Steve, we started the program there in the high school that you're at, the senior thesis program. And so I took a real sort of condensed version, if you will, or a little bit of a truncated version to do a Socratic seminar with eighth graders. We're on trimesters here, and we picked a couple of trimesters to work with the eighth graders, and we're actually in our fourth year, and we've met with a considerable amount of success. Right now, you know, I have the students read original source material.
come into class and a student begins the is responsible for sort of giving an overview of the reading and being ready to engage his classmates in questions and sort of initiate the discussion. And so a student typically would begin the class, and then of course I'm there to kind of help guide the discussion. And to be honest with you, I have to say I'm really impressed with what reader are capable of reading. One of the texts we recently finished was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And the beauty of the pedagogy is that, it's basically a philosophy class. It's basically delving into metaphysics, if you will. And the students, when they read the text, obviously they want to know what the author is saying. That's sort of our initial effort, is asking that question. What is he saying? What does he mean by what is said? Sort of testing what he means, asking whether or not it's true. And then finally, well, so what? What's the relevance of what we've discovered? And I try to get them to focus and look at and find in the text universal principle. Viktor Frankl is wonderful for that. Offers principles in his experience there in the concentration camp, and then of course addressing the big questions: who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? Why is there evil in the world? Why is there pain and suffering? And then providing, using the text as sort of the reference point, providing them the students of parameters to delve into that text and have the author, in this case Viktor Frankl, respond to those questions. So the students are also assigned a paper. They choose a topic from the topics that are presented in the original source material, and we work with the student to iron that out, and then begin to put together an outline and to write a rough draft and to write a more polished draft. But basically, it's an essay. It's for eighth graders, a 3 to 5 page essay. And there's another faculty member there with me. So there's co-tutoring, if you will, or co-teaching going on. And just having the students really experience the value of engaging in dialogue and actually identifying and articulating universal principles that are present there. And of course, very often those principles and experiences challenge our own opinions, which is sort of a central Socratic focus, is to recognize what your opinions are and to challenge those opinions. And if you provide an objective reference point, in this case, the text, Viktor Frankl, then they can use that as a reference point to challenge their own opinion. So it certainly is a philosophical approach. And if I tell the students, if there is a bias, if we have a bias, basically it would be that there is truth, it can be known, and it does matter. So that's pretty much what we're attempting to do. And as I said, I'm pleased to say that eighth graders are far more adept at that than what people might believe.
Yeah, Jason and I on the podcast regularly talk about one of the problems that we see in modern education is an underselling of the student, that we have this horrible habit of dumbing things down to what we think they can handle rather than a calling them up to what perhaps they can at the moment handle, but with the right amount of coaching and modeling and help, they can rise instead of us feeling like we always have to bring it, scaffold it down to their, you don't want to talk over right. Their head, but you want to talk
that's right.
at hair level that's right. rather than navel level, maybe is the way to put it.
Well, that's correct. I mean, we can talk about epistemology and etymology of terms and metaphysics and so forth. And I mean, we don't have to get too involved in that, but that's actually what they're doing. I mean, they're delving into anthropology and trying to understand human nature. And my thought there is that, as much as I'd like to give them a philosophy course and a metaphysics course in metaphysics and so forth, I think at this age, what is more important that than that is the experience. So it's more of an experiential thing where, oh, gee, I can engage in dialogue with these other people. There is an objective reference point that can be utilized to challenge what I think. And then we can arrive at some conclusion or come to some determination. And I think as they experience that, then they say, hey, this is something that I can do and something that's valuable and beneficial. So it's been a good experience.
Well, I'm a big fan of coaching and modeling, of quote unquote, teaching the student to fish rather than just handing them fish. And I know Adler, in his Paideia proposal, put forth this notion of intellectual coaching, and that's really the most substantive, or I think he even used the term permanent, thing that you can impart to a student. They're going to forget a lot of what you told them, but if you help them learn to learn, that's something that's going to stick with them the rest of their life. And so I think the value of the Great Books program is that they are looking at excellent models, right? When we, for instance, go through a rather short discussion of Thomas Aquinas's section of the Summa on law, and right. Aquinas is just marvelous at modeling for them how to deal with both sides of an issue, how to move logically through very deep waters, and all along the way we do Frankl, we do a bunch of books, and they get to interact with these minds and see modeled for them how philosophy's done while they're still young, while they can still, so to speak, have the muscles of their mind formed correctly in the gymnasium that we're putting them in. And I think that's a big deal, that at a very young age, at the level of eighth grade, I've tried it with fifth graders. It was not near as successful as it would be with eighth graders. And yet I find by the time you hit them in high school, and I've had this experience up at college level, the mind starts to think it knows how to think and becomes resistant to being molded.
Yeah,
and yes. So I think there's something about I don't think you can do a seminar with kindergartners, but once the basics of, so to speak, the trivium, how to form words and thoughts has begun, the quicker you can get them into heavy lifting, so to speak, the quicker those mental muscles will develop.
Absolutely, I'm often reminded of the principle that Aristotle posited, that we learn first through imitation, and that we actually delight in it. So if you can find those models and those examples, and they're accessible to young people, then you can give them that which they ought to imitate. And I think too, I'm certainly a fan and an advocate of the great books, but I think the real measure of it's important to select books that are accessible to the age level. But I think what you really want is what I would term a master of orderly thought. And certainly one of the questions out of the Summa is a great example of a master of orderly thought, as is take one of the Federalist Papers. It's a concise argument with a beginning, middle, and end, and sort of presents premises and might even utilize a syllogism and allow you to draw a valid conclusion. And if you can kind of habituate students to doing that, then they'll imitate that. And the masters of orderly thought are going to be the ones that'll enable us to grow and utilize our intellect as it was designed to be used.
Right. And I at the high school level, having a student wrestle with the two ends of the stick, so to speak. On the one hand, on a daily basis, the student is taking a decent-sized chunk of some great work, reading it, outlining it, thinking it through, seeking the questions that are there, having his mind formed by that greater mind. At the other end of the stick, throughout the year, at least in high school, rather than centering it on one given work that we've read, we say to the student, look, you choose something of substantive value, not whether soccer's better than football or something like that, but some, like I have a student this year working on the question, is happiness a choice?
Mm-hmm.
And so all year long, while he's reading other men and seeing how their minds work, he's being forced to try and articulate at a high school level,
right,
a philosophical idea. And wrestle with it. Certainly he's doing a lot of research in what other people have had to say about that question. But the end result, we hope, is his own, to the best of his ability, formed opinion.
That's right.
Of course, in our system, we honor that work. By fourth quarter, a good chunk of my seminar class time is in turn each student presenting their thesis.
Right.
The students are expected to read it before the class.
That's right.
And then treat it just like they've treated Augustine or whomever else.
That's right.
Here, my classmate has struggled with this all year and has put this mm-hmm. out as clearly mm-hmm. as they can. Now, what do we think? And wrestle with it just the same way they have everything else. And I think that knowing that they're going to have to present it puts a certain amount of motivation to do a good job.
No, it definitely does. They tend to want to do a good job in front of their peers. So,
well, my thoughts are going to be examined by my peers, and
that's right.
Teachers there to make sure it doesn't get too cruel. But nonetheless, there's an honor. You know, I think they're the best seminars of the year.
I agree.
In part because it's at the end, and so they should be the best at doing what they're doing. But mm-hmm. also because this is not some stranger to me. This is my classmate.
That's
and
right.
and if it's been done well, I know when you were running this program at my school, you even had the thesis table at lunch,
and I
wish that. I wish that could continue. It hasn't. Now that we have multiple lunches, they're not able to do that. But the notion that they've been talking amongst themselves mm-hmm. about their ideas for an extended period of time, this is a big deal to me, as I see many of these kids are not used to thinking about a thought for more than 3 or 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've upped it to 40 minutes, 45 minutes if we're...
Yeah.
Going the whole period.
I'm doing an hour and 15 minutes with eighth graders right now, and it seems like an awful long time, but it can be done. And really what you're habituating them to is what I would call sustained rational discourse.
Yes. Yeah. And the sustained seems to be the hardest part.
Well, it does. But, you know, the other thing about the selection of the topic, certainly it needs to have some profundity to it and so forth. But, you know, I always remind the kids, you know, choose something that you're interested in. And if you're writing a paper over the course of the year, you choose something you can fall in love with.
Yeah.
And
there's nothing worse than being stuck with a topic that becomes uninteresting to you after a few days of consideration. So
that's right. If it's an area of discovery that you can actually fall in love with, you know, beauty in some aspect of music or the visual arts and whatnot, then that's something that you ought to pursue. And then you know that if I'm pursuing a topic that I do love, in all likelihood, I'm going to be right there to the very end and be interested in what I'm doing and have some passion and so forth. The other, I'm thinking back of some of the students in your school that had done some papers. I remember one year a student asking, well, can we do something that we've never done before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I said, oh, by all means, right? Something that you've always thought you'd like to delve into, and you've never had the opportunity. Here's your opportunity. So those were the best conversations that you had all year long, was when you got to the end and the students were actually reading each other's papers. And the benefit I would always tell them, we actually have the author here at the table, so we can really delve into these questions, and you can find out what, you know, what kinds of challenges they met along the way.
And I've seen students change their mind.
Right.
Start out on one side of an issue and then come back kind of pleading, can I please change my thesis? Well, I don't want it to be changed in subject matter, but if you mean I've studied and thought and now don't agree with what my thesis, I'm taking the other side.
Right.
You now have a choice. You can go ahead and continue, or you can jump to the other side. But in the end, probably at your age, if it's really something you're passionate about, there's the good chance that in big or small ways, your mind's going to be changing or growing or reaching a better understanding about this the rest of your life. So,
right. That's right. And if you're, you know, if you're pursuing something that's truly transcendent and in the realm of the true or the good or the beautiful. It's a reality that already exists, and you're on a journey of discovery. So you might set out on the journey in one direction and then discover that this reality that I'm encountering is drawing me in another direction. So that would certainly be justification for modifying or shifting your topic as you proceed.
So I'm going to move our conversation to a side that I think is important for the notion of a podcast, but isn't always my favorite thing to come across, which is objections to what you and I are doing. I know, especially as an administrator, you probably get an earful from time to time about various arguments against this, that it's a poor use of instructional time, or that it's outdated. You know, sure, the thesis was a great idea back in the 1800s or whatnot, but we're in the technological age and so on. Maybe just discuss with me some of the ones that you've wrestled with and that you feel, you know, you have some sort of a brief reply to. Yeah. And then I'm gonna close it up by challenging you to give me just as succinct and positive a defense of why in 2020 the seminar program should still be alive and well. That Socratic teaching is still just as legitimate now as it was in Socrates' time.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you were talking about that, what was kind of coming to my mind, an objection would be, right, who has time given the cost of education, particularly as you get into the higher secondary, post-secondary education, nobody has time to spend pursuing these great questions. You know, one thing I used to say to the high school kids when I was there was, I want your education to be useful. It's important that it is. You need ultimately to take care of yourself and be independent and feed your family and so on and so forth. But I also said to them, if your education is not meaningful, I've failed as an educator. So the utility, and of course, living in America, we want to be practical and always looking at the utilitarian aspect of things. I feel like the utility is going to be addressed by plenty of other institutions in other places, but if we don't give them meaningful, then I think we've really shortchanged our students. So that just sort of came to my mind, and of course with the I was fortunate enough to go to 4 years undergrad, great books, great questions, great ideas, reading original source, and it's tough to convince people that they should send or spend 4 years doing that. But I where are young people going to get that opportunity? It's as Socrates say, the purpose of the liberal arts is to live life well, to have the freedom to do that. And I think that too often in education today, we don't think about that. We forget about that. So I would argue that the Socratic method and the engaging those masters of orderly thought and attempting sustained rational discourse, I would argue that this is what's truly most natural to any human being. I think this is one of the great deficiencies in education today, that we don't have a good sense of human nature and the purpose of the human being. But to me, this is just what we're doing in the Socratic seminar with the original source material and engaging in dialogue. It's a truly human endeavor. Joseph Pieper wrote the beautiful book published the beautiful book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture. Without spending that time, taking that time, and enjoying that time with friends to ask the big questions and go to the wise individuals who have spent a lot of time and effort trying to respond to those questions. If we're not doing that, then we're diminishing the value of education. We're really diminishing our students. We're shortchanging them. So yes, education should be useful, and people need to be able to do things and achieve things once that's accomplished. But if it's not meaningful, then we've really truncated the experience of learning that to me is just part of being a human being, being a fulfilled human being, and giving you the opportunity to live life well as a human being.
Well, I'll tell you a story just for your enjoyment. My seminar class was hit today by an out-of-school activity that took about half of my seniors out of class for the day. And that always challenges me. The ones I was left with were folks who tend to be a little bit more introverted and less forthcoming in seminar. And I was facing either a very – well, I just had a decision to make. And so I decided to take a break. It's a Friday. They're kind of bummed that they have to be in school and their other friends are out running around the woods. And so I said, you know, I don't think I'd do this enough for you. I don't think I model for you what we're talking about. But there's the YouTube is fantastic because it's got great conversation out there if you want to find it. And I said, I wanted to put in front of you a gentleman that passed away this past year anyway. He was a hero of mine, Roger Scruton, a tremendous philosopher in his own right, in particular, a writer on the subject of beauty, which means a lot to me. And he had done a thing at Cambridge with Jordan Peterson, another fellow who's basically made his way into the higher echelons of discussion and conversation and whatnot. And the two of them had a discussion at Cambridge a while back on the subject of apprehending transcendence. And it's there on the internet. And I wasn't setting anything up. I just knew this was there and thought for 30 minutes they could pay attention to a carefully constructed but spontaneous conversation between two minds about this great subject of what is transcendence, how do we interact with it, you know, what does it do to us, that sort of thing.
Sounds wonderful.
It was, but the gist of the first 35, 40 minutes of their discussion is showing that there are some people who find transcendence difficult and because they're poorly skilled, they find it confusing. And so they have a tendency to just sort of, in the terms of the conversants, sleep through life. And then there are others who fight up into the transcendent. You can't make it happen. It's a very mystical, mysterious thing. But just observing life and having conversation as often as you can have it, reading good books, etc. There are these moments that are unplanned, spontaneous, but they occur, and your soul is lifted up into the heavens.
Right.
And what I noticed is that as they're having this conversation, there are two different things happening in the classroom. There are a number of young fellows going to sleep,
right,
and a few others that are leaning forward and really getting into the conversation and are upset when the bell rings. It is a truth, I think, that while all of us are philosophers and all of us yearn for transcendence, we have to be careful in our society to not as you started out, things sell youth short, that this is just too hard for them. And B, not let them settle for less. You know, that if I get the A or if I pass the class, that's all my – that there's something, as you said, more meaningful to the school than just the degree or the game of the grades.
That's right.
And it was just sort of – I didn't expect for their conversation to flesh itself out in front of me in my classroom, but it did. So –
Something that's universally true. You know, it reminds me as well as we just with the eighth graders we just read today from Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America concerning the philosophical approach of Americans. One of the reasons that we do that is I think Socrates would say it's important to examine your cultural opinions.
Yes,
you know, we've been habituated as Americans to be industrious and to be practical and to always be useful. And he points out that, you know, in this democratic culture, we don't, there's not much time for speculation or speculative thought. And that requires some training, an introduction to it, and then training, and then, you know, hopefully the wonderful experience of encountering the transcendent. And I think once that occurs, then you can step back and let it go because they're going to be on fire with what they encounter.
Yeah, it's there's so many, and I'm not a fisherman, but I've fished enough to know that there's a difference between the sort of theoretical training, here's how you cast and here's how you do things, and then that moment when the bait is struck,
That's
right?
right.
And the fish is there.
Yep.
And you're now wrestling with a fish on the line.
Right. And that experience is what keeps you coming back.
Well, John, I thank you at two levels. One, as an Irishman, I thank you for saving our civilization for us.
Oh, you're
That's probably a
welcome.
podcast at another time.
We're always ready to
But
be at service. That's just part of our ethic and part of our nationality.
well, we appreciate that, and also thank you for your life of service in trying to get students to see that there's something higher than just an A. That there's a grade, so to speak, that's beyond report, and that even in the mundane of life, there are moments that can shine for us. I appreciate the moments that our conversation has produced both today and in our history together, and look forward to more.
Great.
And again, appreciate you taking some time today to talk to us about something I know is near and dear to you and to me, and we hope will be an ever-growing part of recovery in American education.
Right. Well, I would just say ditto back to you, Steve, and thank you for all your effort, and most importantly, thank you for your friendship.
Thank you, sir.
You don't eat your vegetables.